Here it is. Roller Alto Barrel Podcast, the Vintage Baseball Podcast. Talking to vintage baseball players from coast to coast, border to border. Finding the interesting things out about them instead of just you knowing them as a baseball player. That's kind of what we do around here. And yesterday we had Johnny Laura from the Flat Rock Baseball Club. Tomorrow I have Sean LaRue from the Bay City Independence of Michigan Ball Club. But today on the phone line, not sponsored, never will be, all the way from Nashville, Tennessee, it's Timothy Shadetree Davis. Timothy, Tim, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Great. First question. How old were you, because your name is Timothy Charles Davis, how old were you when you realized you had the name of a serial killer? Not an actual serial killer, but you got to admit, when you hear Timothy Charles Davis, you're like, that guy's a serial killer.
Well, interestingly, there is a serial killer, a killer that is named Timothy Charles Davis.
Oh, geez. I didn't even look that up. Got to Google it.
Yeah, I used to tell people that if you Googled Timothy Charles Davis, like, that I was the one that came up first, and I was not the one who was on death row in Alabama. So,
does that make you important? Where does that put you in the in the food chain?
You know, if you're going to be easily found on Google, I suppose it's better to, you know, be for positive actions than killing someone, but allegedly killing someone.
So along the same question line, your vintage baseball nickname is Shadetree, but you prefer to be called Shady. What is up with this all of a sudden?
Well, let me go back to the Timothy Charles Davis is because that's more of what I call my writing name, and that my name is Tim Davis. And so there's like, even among writers, there are about 40 other Tim Davises. So you have to kind of like set yourself apart a little bit. So that's kind of more of my writing name. So I'm not like, you know, Tim Davis is not too far away from like John Smith or something.
If you had stuck with the fiction writing, would you have changed your name to something?
I still reserve the right to do it at some point. I've definitely come up with some potential, you know, names that I could go with, or variations on my own name. That I don't want to do the initial and then middle name, last name thing. But yeah, I've thought about it for sure.
So before we get into the journalism, the author, the teacher, and all the personal things about you, we always start with vintage baseball. And that, yeah. And that's where we're going to start. So how is it going in the, I believe it's the, what is the Tennessee Association of Vintage Baseball?
Mm-hmm.
How is it going this season?
It's going well. I realize I did not answer your Shadetree question, but.
We move around. Let's go back to that. Your nickname is Shadetree. You prefer Shady. I was just making the correlation of serial killer name anyway.
It gets shortened to Shady more than like when we do the introductions at the end of the at the beginning of the game. I always say Shadetree, but everybody on my team calls me Shady, and I don't know if it's because of, you know, Eminem being Slim Shady and my name being Tim, so it's Tim Shady.
I didn't even think of that one. That's great. The original Tim Shady.
that could be it.
So how'd you get the name Shadetree?
I just totally made it up. I thought it sounded like I wanted something sort of like kind of laid back sounding, you know, like I didn't want to be like, there's a guy in our league. He actually is a guy I really enjoy, but his name is like El Caballo or the Bull. I think that's what Bull is in Spanish. Or, you know, there's a lot of guys with aggressive nicknames, and I wanted something that would sort of make you think of, you know, having a piece of grass in your mouth, just kind of like taking it easy. So Shadetree seemed kind of relaxed.
And nappy. It sounds like you're taking a nap.
Like the game's going on and I'm leaning against a tree and, you know, just over there taking it easy.
I hope that the guy who calls himself the Bull in Spanish is a Hispanic gentleman. Would that be true?
He is. His name is Pedro Hernandez. He's a heck of a player too.
So you're on the Cumberland Baseball Club of Nashville, Tennessee. You are in Nashville, right?
Yes. We play at the Hermitage, which the Hermitage is basically the home grounds of Andrew Jackson. Excuse me. And the Hermitage is about 15 miles outside of Nashville, but yeah, we're the Cumberland Club of Nashville. And supposedly, I don't know the exact history, but for like a year and a half, there was a baseball team here in Nashville called the Cumberland Club of Nashville that played in one of those sort of outlaw leagues. But three or four teams in our league, the East Nashville Phoenix as well, can trace their history, so to speak, back to an actual team that was here like after the Civil War.
So at the Hermitage, you're playing in the backyard of Andrew Jackson's old home?
Not only the backyard, we probably, like, home plate is probably about 200 yards from, like, the back porch of his house.
So when did he live in this house?
Post-presidency, obviously, but, I was an English major and not towards the end of his life, so probably, like, the last 20, 25 years of his life.
Oh, so he died there?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed... in past interviews I've had with some Tennessee guys, we talk about locations, and just about every location in your association is a historical a place that you play at. Is that right?
Yeah, for the most part. There are a few that are kind of more like, so there's one like a Bicentennial Mall, which is kind of like it's a sort of a mall, and they're like, you say mall to like my students these days, they think you're talking about a shopping mall, but it's a park that is right in front of, it faces the state capitol. So a few of them are in public parks. There's another one in Murfreesboro that is sort of in a park. It's a mix, but I would say like some of them are on like Ripa Villa is in Spring Hill, Tennessee. That's an old plantation house. So, yeah, it sort of depends. Some of our places we have played this year have been sort of like, we're playing less widely varied places owing to like some of the places not opening back up because of COVID and such.
Oh, sure. The blue shirts you guys wear are, I love them. I love them. But do you get any... crooked looks from outside of the Tennessee area with that blue?
Honestly, we don't play that many outside. We've had folks from Michigan before. We play an Indianapolis team a few times a year. I think there's a St. Louis squad that comes here. So last year we started out and we had these uniforms, which we're wearing again, and guys didn't like them because they were insanely blousy. You know, it's like you could be an Adonis and wear one of these things and it would look like you were, you know, weighed about 300 pounds. But, so last year we went with a more form fitting kind of the uniform with the sort of the bib on the front with the buttons.
Uh-huh.
And then we realized about three or four games in the season that wearing black canvas jerseys in the middle of summer in Tennessee was not a good idea.
Yeah, probably not.
And so we went back to the all cotton turquoise one. Sometimes we call ourselves the turquoise boys. So we went back to those. And I don't know that they're everyone's favorite, but of all the other teams in the league, like players will come up to us and say, like, well, at least you don't have to wear these big woolen, you know, things that are, you know, like you see guys coming over and half the time it's because they're wearing these like really traditional looking uniforms, but they're, you know, dying because of the heat.
Sure.
We played last week, I believe, and the heat index was above 100. So like hard enough just wearing shorts and a t-shirt, much less all the stuff that we wear.
You played, I'm looking at your schedule right now, actually, you played the Mountain City Club of Chattanooga.
Yes.
And that was a home game.
Yes. Played is a it's a kind term to them and to us. Yeah, they walloped us pretty good, but the Chattanooga team. So usually how we work this is Chattanooga is 2 hours away. Knoxville is 3 hours away. So usually when we play those teams, like if they come here, they'll play a doubleheader. And if we go there, we'll play a doubleheader. So we usually visit, like the teams from Nashville will go to Chattanooga once a year and Knoxville once a year and sort of get those games out of the way. And then we spend the majority of the time playing all the other teams.
So
kind of in the general Nashville area.
In the format of your association, do you have certain requirements of how often you have to play, or do you have to play everybody every year? Is that just the requirement?
I think the idea is that we try to. I'm looking now. I think we have 10 or 11. We had one team that didn't have enough this year that has kind of folded into our team.
Okay.
So we have three or four guys on our team from the Highland Rim Distillers who have these really cool sort of uniforms that are basically like kind of like overalls, but they're kind of look like they're made out of sackcloth, and they just kind of wear these old kind of floppy hats that, you know, they probably have the most like realistic uniforms to like what guys were wearing in 1864. But so we have three or four of those guys on our team. And so like you will see our team. And so you have a bunch of guys wearing blousy blue shirts. And then you have a bunch of two or three guys wearing really baggy, like tan suspender looking things made out of, you know, it looks like potato sacks or something.
So it's polar opposites on the same team. Well,
yeah, people often kind of ask, you know, what's going on. And so they kind of folded into our team. Going into the season, we were kind of short on folks. And so like, it's been pretty good because we have a lot of folks that need to miss games. We have two or three people that work for the Nashville Sounds. And so a lot of times in the summer, if you know, the team is doing a homestand, that's the AAA team of the Brewers. Mm-hmm. So if they're having a homestand, you know, they're called on to work a lot of times on Saturday and Sunday. So having a larger team has really helped us this year because we have a fair amount of people that need to miss for whatever reason.
I think that's something we always talk about on here is, the shortage of players that seems to be getting worse and worse every year and how we can reverse those effects. You know, people got responsibilities, they got jobs, they got families. And when people have young kids and the kids are getting older, it's time to do more dad things. And, you don't have time to just make this commitment. It's a commitment to play vintage baseball, but it's like the last commitment on your list, which I don't fault anybody for, but unfortunately that seems to be the trend. So,
yeah, I have to admit, you know, seeing the same thing here. I had some ideas kind of on that, on like how to kind of reach different people. I ran for, you know, our league office last year and didn't win. So, but yeah, there's I definitely think that, I mean, I say our league, but I think all leagues could do a better job at, you know, maybe targeting people that do have a little bit more free time. And by that, I mean, you know, people like under 40. You know, I would say the vast, I have no idea, but I would want to say the median, you know, age range in our league is probably 35 to 45. And like, that's, like you said, that's prime, you know, having young children time, or like prime, I'm in the, you know, the midst of my career and like, I'm being called to fly to so-and-so place or do this or that. And, you know, it's unfortunately the age range of a lot of us is also the age range where you have a lot of other things to do.
And you also pull a lot of hammies in that age range.
You do. Yeah, that you do. You knock on wood, I haven't done that yet.
Yeah, you have a hard time getting out of bed the next day.
What's the old saying that, you know, everyone can go on the 2 week disabled list after every game?
Yes, I can do that. I should do that. I wish we did that. Hey, Tim, tell me why God hates Nashville so much.
Are you referring to all the like natural disasters and
yes,
stuff we have?
I am. I tell you, just as this was March, I believe, of 2020, you guys had the tornadoes down there. So I came down with my wife, and we did some volunteering down there for cleanup.
Oh,
and
thank you.
And while we were there, we found out about these incredible floods that you guys have had. And it just, now it just seems like every time I turn on, there's bad weather happening in Nashville. Didn't you guys just have like a normal bad thunderstorm within the last couple of weeks?
Well, last night we had, and I mean, this is coincidence that this is going on because I don't want people to further the assumption that all that goes on in Nashville is country music. But so, yeah, we had a big thunderstorm last night and a lot of shows downtown. So Phil Lesh from the Grateful Dead was playing downtown. Garth Brooks was playing at Nissan Stadium, which is where the Titans play. And, you know, these shows got canceled because, like, we lost power downtown everywhere. I don't know if it's I don't know if it's the wrath of God or just a run of bad luck.
But didn't you have?
We also had the Christmas bombing. Yeah.
Oh yes, that's right. The weird Winnebago with the music downtown.
Yeah.
Going on. That was. Did they ever find out a motive for that?
Without getting too into it, he was a. I don't want to go into a political. He was a kind of a conspiracy theorist sort of guy that believed that 5G technology was, you know, killing everyone and passing the COVID virus and stuff. And, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So did he.
Shame we lost that guy.
Did he think his plan was going to work or did he just want to bring attention to it?
I think he must have been wanting to bring attention to it because it did not seem very well thought out. But,
no.
I mean, it was well thought out enough that, you know, happened. But I don't think these things never, like, really bring about the sort of, like, call to action that these people tend to think it's going to cause, it seems like.
Didn't you have a tornado in Nashville before the one in 2020 that wiped out the stadium that the Titans played at?
It missed the stadium.
Oh, okay.
It tore through. We have a massive tornado about every 10 years. And so we had, you know, we had the big floods in 2010, I think it was. But like right around, 20 years ago or so, we had another huge tornado that came through and it's owing to the topography, if that's the right word, of Nashville. Is that like the way the city sort of sits is that like when these weather patterns build, I don't know if it's like East Nashville is the sort of flat area or whatever, but it always seems to hit and go through East Nashville. It's while East Nashville is a very hip place to live, as it says in all the magazines and such, part of why beginning like in, 2000, 2005, part of why East Nashville was like this resurgent part of the city was because the tornado had hit us, all these places got insurance money. And so people were able to come in and either buy property cheaply or rebuild things. And so it was a situation that has kind of been repeated now. Like a lot of the buildings or businesses that have been here a long time got torn down and so new things have taken its place and kind of, it would make me very wary if I thought about building something along that sort of stretch of, there's a road called Gallatin Road, which kind of goes all the way through East Nashville. And I would be real wary of building anything on that street, I feel like. But
okay, so as you can tell, I'm not a professional journalist because we're just going to bounce all over the place. We're going right back to Vintage Baseball. Boom!
Okay.
How did you get involved with Vintage Baseball?
I had mentioned the Bicentennial Mall before, and that's right beside the Nashville Farmers Market. And the Farmers Market has one of these things. It's what I would call like a high-end food court. So it's like all these different ethnic foods and such and like little mom and pop kind of places within the Farmers Market. And so it's a nice place to go to eat when you don't know what you want to eat. You know, like you have a lot of options. And so I took my lunch and I went and sat outside. Went to go sit out in the park. And, honestly, it's that thing of like you see a bunch of guys walking around in weird uniforms. And it so happens that the team that I saw was Cumberland Club playing another team. I don't remember who it was. And, I didn't say anything to any of the guys that day, I don't think. I think I took some video. And I came home and I told my wife about it. And I saw guys on the team that kind of looked like me, which is to say, you know, like not high end athletes, but guys that looked like they were having fun and kind of, reignited that sort of childhood part of me where I was like, I wanted to get out there and like, I wanted to jump out there that day. I feel like I still see that at our games sometimes. Why I think a lot of the players in vintage baseball are always real good about talking to folks when they come up and ask questions is that, you know, we've all been that person who came up to a game and asked questions and like, and joined, you know? So yeah, it was seeing a game, and it was in the midst of maybe the 2017, 2018 season. I don't remember at this point. And so I contacted the league and said, can I go ahead and put my installment down or go ahead and put my payment down so I can play next year? And they were like, hey, there's a team that needs folks for this year. If you want to go ahead and play a few games for free to kind of get your feet wet. And, within seeing them play at the Bicentennial Mall, I think within 3 weeks I was like playing for them. So it happened very quickly. I wasn't expecting to get to play that quickly. And, you know, it took a while to kind of learn the nuances of everything, obviously. But
what was your understanding level of baseball before you played vintage?
Understanding in that I'd been a lifetime baseball fan, like knowledge of the rules of the game and everything. Of regular baseball, very right. High.
Okay.
And, you know, had played, I played as a kid. I didn't play any higher than, you know, like I played like sandlot baseball basically, but I've been a lifelong baseball fan and kind of like, you know, I played enough where I knew how to swing and kind of like, you know, I knew I would be okay. If not a, you know, I wasn't going to be Rod Carew or anything, but I figured I could get up there and get a few hits occasionally.
Well, that's an old reference. Rod Carew. So for everybody that just said Rod Carew, was this, he's actually a very good left-handed hitter with this crazy batting stance. He was like in a full crouch almost. Oh my God.
Yeah. That's a timely reference, wasn't it? And then the second thing that popped in my head was Tony Gwynn. And I was like, well, that's not much better.
No, it is better. I think that one is better. As far as, okay. Well, depending on what you're going for. If you want to go more obscure, I mean, Rod Carew is a Hall of Famer, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess it's not an obscure reference, but but Tony Gwynn, no, people still talk about Tony Gwynn all the time.
I'm very much a singles hitter and always kind of have been. And so, like, I always liked those guys more than the home run guys. I think because I always, you know, somewhere in my head as a kid, I imagined that there was some tiny chance that I could be, you know, Tony Gwynn or Wade Boggs more than there was, you know, Mark McGwire or whatever.
Sure.
So they seemed more approachable as major league players, I guess.
Tell me about some of your favorite places that you've played while playing vintage. How many years have you been playing?
This would be, well, not counting the COVID season, I guess this is like the third full season.
Okay.
I think third or fourth.
So you've been around a little bit. Some of your favorite places you've gotten to go travel to and play?
Yeah, so mostly I've played, we play every year, we play a game in Tuscumbia, Alabama, and we play, it's the Heine Mannush. I mean, you want to talk about old baseball references. Hall of Famer from Tuscumbia, Alabama, right beside Muscle Shoals, if folks know where that is. And so they have a game every year, and they have like a day or two celebrating, you know, this Hall of Famer came from this small town and Tuscumbia. And so we always play like a group of like local dignitaries and such. Local dignitaries, you know, the mayor and city council or whatever. And so we always bring a team or two teams down there. And so that's always a lot of fun because you get to play on this like really nice high school baseball field. It's real manicured and, you know, like you don't have to worry about twisting your ankle like you do in most of the parks in our league. And then, but here in town, like I really love, I love the Bicentennial Mall because it's in the midst of this stretch of grass. And so from home plate to right field is, it's like one of those old ballparks where the dimensions of the outfield are like crazy different. And so like to hit it out, or to hit it to like what would be quote the fence in left field, it's a long way, but in right field, it's these two huge trees that, that stand in the middle of the outfield. And as a left-handed hitter, like I feel like when I get up there on that park, that I feel like a power hitter, you know, like I can hit it further because right field is so short. But that's a place too that always has, like, we always have tons of, you know, I don't know, do they call them cranks where you are as well, like the fans?
They do.
And so there's always a lot of folks there just, you know, enjoying their lunch or, you know, having their blankets in the park and stuff. So that's always a great place to play because the energy is really good. Of, you know, there are tons of people there asking questions and taking pictures. Ripa Villa, which is in Spring Hill, is out back of this plantation in the midst of an actual field. But the field is sort of mowed out of, if you will, a cornfield. And so if you go to certain times of the year, it really does look like Field of Dreams. Like, you know, right behind the field is this huge cornfield. And you almost imagine, like, you could, you know, about everybody that goes out there at some point has someone take a picture of them walking out of the cornfield, like a Field of Dreams. So we have a bunch of unique places. Oakland's Mansion in Murfreesboro is a really nice place. Yeah, those are just some that pop into my head. But the Hermitage is an awesome place. I love the places that have quirks. Like, so our field at the Hermitage, like, you kind of run a little bit uphill to go to first, downhill to go to second, a little bit more downhill to go to third, and then when you're running from third to home, it's like a climb. So it's like you're running up a hill. So it's like, you know, you get to know these quirks, and you kind of get to know, like, how to play them. And, like our home field, like, you know, if you hit it in a certain place, it's really going to take off and roll a long ways. And, you know, you learn, like, the little tricks of playing at each park. So that's the kind of thing that I really like.
Sure.
Each park is very different from each other.
When you're playing on your field, if you're on first base and you have to score on the guy behind you's triple or something, I mean, you get around third base, you're already tired, and now you're running uphill to get score?
It's not an insignificant, like, incline. It's noticeable. Like, you cannot, when you're standing on third, you cannot see home. You know, you just know that you're running in that general direction and that you will find home once you get up there.
I looked up Heine Mannuch, and he actually played on the Detroit Tigers from 20.
He played beside
with Ty Cobb.
Yeah, he was teammate of Ty Cobb. I want to say he had 3,000 hits. I could be wrong about that. But.
Yeah, when you're a teammate of Ty Cobb, you're pretty much lost. In the whole history of everything, looks like he had 2,524 hits, but he did have a 330 career batting average. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, nothing to sneeze at.
No, absolutely not. And he was traded to the St. Louis Browns with a guy by the name of Lou Blue. So. There's a little nugget for everybody to forget immediately.
Yeah, it's really neat. Like when we went down there, like, you know, getting to meet, like, you know, he still has, like, living family, like his I wanted to say his, like, sons and daughters, or I mean, like, they're, you know, like, his oldest children are now, like, in their 80s and 90s. But it's just really neat to be able to, like, kind of, you know, talk to these folks and kind of they always love it when we come down there. Like, we always, like, they all want to take pictures with us. And, you know, we usually go back to, like, they usually have, like, a little spread for us with sandwiches and stuff after the game. And it's, you know, we're super jazzed to be there for them. And to, because everybody in our league, you know, I'm sure it's the same way there, is you know, you get into this because you're a fan of baseball and baseball history. You know, you probably get the few guys who are, like, and I mean, no disrespect to, like, softball guys, but you probably get a few guys who want to kind of continue their baseball career. But most of us are just people who love baseball and kind of, like, want a chance to kind of be a kid again, you know? And like every time I that's why I think sometimes like when I first joined the league and you would put on the uniform, I'd feel kind of silly. And now I kind of like, you know, I'm like, this is really fun that I get to do this.
Oh, absolutely. I also am a player that doesn't have the skill set to think of glory when he takes the field. I just do it to smell the grass and to be outdoors and for the exercise and the camaraderie. That's all the good stuff to me. I wouldn't mind being really good for a day, though.
Well, you know, I mentioned to you and kind of like us talking before this, but like having, you know, our team hasn't won a lot of games. Let's put it that way. I think we've won 3 games since I've been on the team. But what is so fun is like, I mean, you know, I go out there and like, I'm just like, I really am like for, it's not a whole lot of times in my life, but like I get to go out there and kind of like, feel like a kid and go out there and like just it's the like hanging around talking to the guys and gals. We have 2 gals on our team. And just hanging around with folks and kind of, you know, just talking baseball and you know, warming up before the game and throwing the ball around and jogging around and, you know, jibing and, you know, making stupid jokes and stuff. Like that's the fun part. The talking to guys from the other team and kind of, you know, the game is fun, but it's the whole totality of the thing. It's kind of the same way, like, when you go see a game at a ballpark. Like, most of the time, like, you might have a rooting interest, but most of the time you just go because you, like, want to see a baseball game, you know?
Oh, sure.
Like, that's the draw more than, like, win or lose.
Especially when you travel to different towns, you're like, oh, I got to go see a baseball game at this stadium, even though you don't care if it's a game between the Reds and the Brewers. You're like, who cares? If you're not, you know, like I'm a Tigers fan, I'll go see a Mariners Angels game if I can go see it at their stadium, you know.
Oh, sure. Yeah, like you said, it's like seeing the park is almost like seeing, you know, just seeing a baseball too. Like all the parks are, you know, they're not these cookie cutter kind of parks. Well, most of them, at least.
Not anymore.
And to, you know, and to kind of see like these, yeah, and you know, sometimes you just want, like, a friend of mine calls it the rhythm of the ballpark, like when you go out and see a game. And, you know, it's kind of unhurried, and it's kind of like a step away from, some people might argue, too unhurried. But, you know, I don't mind a long baseball game. I'm usually kind of like, I'm not one of those people that, like, leaves in the 6th inning, so.
Oh, no, I avoid the traffic by staying a half an hour after the last pitch. So, okay. So tell me about this, the Hot Chicken Cookbook, the fiery history of red hot recipes of Nashville's beloved bird.
Yeah, so that's a book that I guess I wrote in 2014 that came out in 2015. That is about one of the very things that we titled it. So Nashville Hot Chicken is kind of, I mean, I don't know. It's pretty nationwide, I feel like, at this point, but I guess it's kind of it's a very distinctive food. I mean, I would argue way better than like Cincinnati skyline chili, but it's the food that is very much connected with Nashville, the way a cheese steak might be to Philly or and so yeah, it's this very hot sort of preparation of chicken that is a lot different than like buffalo wings. And so I had met with a friend of mine who used to be a literary editor at the Oxford American, and we were talking about food. We would always get together and like just meet and hang out. And since I didn't drink anymore, we would go meet and have lunch. And so we would have tacos or hot chicken. And one day we were talking about like, you know, somebody should, there was like stories on hot chicken out there, but nobody had like really written. There was no place that was like a compendium of like the information and the stories that were out there about how the food started, and that sort of thing. And we talked about it, and then we both kind of came to each other at the same time and said, like, why don't we do this? And so he had started a publishing company with a friend of his. And so, yeah, so I wrote the book and, spent a lot of time kind of like doing research, if you will, that probably took years off my stomach. But and yeah, and so I got a Carla Hall, he used to be on the Chew. She wrote an introduction, and then Andrew Zimmern, who from the Food Network, who does the bizarre foods and stuff, he did a like an introduction as well, or a forward. I forget which one did which. And yeah, so it for whatever reason, that was right when Nashville kind of became an it city, sort of in popular media, and it all kind of took off at once. And so, you know, hot chicken places started opening up. Like, there are like 6 or 7, 8 different hot chicken restaurants in LA, and so like there are hot chicken places in Milwaukee and El Paso. And but all this kind of started around the same time the book was coming out. So kind of to our surprise, we thought it might, you know, sell 1,000 or 2 copies, I think. And you know, it I think at last look, it's going into its like 5th or 6th printing, and probably sold 15,000-20,000 copies, maybe.
No kidding. Can you get this on Amazon?
Yeah, Amazon, and yeah, any place you buy books. It's always cheesy when you say that, but yeah. But,
like any you have to any do the plug.
any online retailer, yeah, that has books.
But this book was not born out of you and cooking and your love of chicken. It was born out of the fact that you're an author, right?
No, for whatever reason, like when I started writing about food, like around 2002, 2003, I got really great feedback from food writing. And so I just naturally kind of leaned into doing that more. I'd always loved food and written about food to a lesser extent, like at local papers and such. But so I wrote something, I got involved with the Southern Foodways Alliance. And a guy named John T. Edge here, Southern Foodways Alliance is run out of Ole Miss. And so I wrote a couple of chapters of the Southern Foodways Alliance community cookbook in like 2007, 2008. And so I just sort of got tied in with Southern food and wrote a lot about Southern food specifically. And so I had always had an interest in food and specifically Southern food, and I have I've worked in restaurants for a long time, so I would describe myself as like a good home cook. Like, I've worked in professional restaurants and kind of know that side of it, but I'm no chef, and I definitely have huge holes in my knowledge that, you know, things that I don't. But I've always been a very passionate home cook, I suppose, and this was kind of an extension of that, and I really love like the stories. And maybe this is my, you know, writing and storytelling background, but I've always loved the stories behind the food. And so, you know, hot chicken has this like rather dramatic origin story, if you will, to use a comic book term. And if folks don't know, so hot chicken was supposedly created when there's a guy named Thornton Prince who would later go on to start Prince's Hot Chicken. But supposedly he was out philandering one night, and his girlfriend, or, you know, partner at the time, got tired of it. And so, like, the next morning or the next, you know, lunchtime the next day, made him chicken, but, like, doused it with cayenne pepper and all these hot spices to basically punish him. And it said that it had the opposite effect, and he actually was like, hey, you know, I think I'm onto something. And went on to kind of replicate it, and later on actually started a restaurant selling this like hot spicy chicken. So, you know, it's got this like kind of crazy, really, not a lot of foods have an origin story like that. That's so, you know, whether or not it's 100% true, it's a very good story. So,
well, you live in Nashville. You're originally from Charlotte, North Carolina. Yeah. What would you consider Charlotte's food that they're known for, sort of?
Oh man, hopefully nobody from Charlotte's listening. That's a good one. I'm sure something will come up the second we get off of this, but okay. I don't know that there's something like, you know, like I don't know that there's something like a buffalo wing or a cheesesteak or Cincinnati style chili. I mean, with Charlotte was a lot of like Southern food. So like, you know, that classic kind of Southern food, but like nothing sticks out. There's the idea of the fish camp. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but
no.
So a fish camp is basically something that, like, there's a lot of rivers and lakes and such around Charlotte. And so it was basically a little place where fishermen would catch their fish, and these little fish camps would be like on the shore of wherever it was. And so, like, they would basically just sell fish and like French fries and hush puppies. But it was a place where you could get this fish that was caught, like, you know, hours before and quickly prepared and served to you. So it basically like these little like fish shacks, if you will. But I think the fish camp is often thought of as a North Carolina thing.
You got degrees from the Queen's University of Charlotte in fiction and creative writing, and yet you specialize in nonfiction. How did that happen?
Well, by the time I had gotten to Queens, I actually got into Queens a little bit short of having my bachelor's. So I got in their master's program a few credits short of getting my bachelor's, owing to the fact that I had written a lot. Some of the writing that I've been telling you about, I had done while I was in school. So I went back to school later on. I went to college right after high school, lasted about a year and dropped out, and then worked at a furniture company loading trucks for the better part of 6 or 7 years, and decided that was a hard work and started going back to school. So I got into Queens. And partially I had been doing nonfiction the whole time. I was working at a newspaper by the time I got into Queens. And so I was also writing for like salon.com and some of these, more national outlets. And, they let me in not having a full bachelor's degree based on like life experience. And so part of why I ended up, I really wanted my goal at that time was that I wanted to write a novel, But I still retained that sort of, credibility of writing nonfiction. And so the short answer is nonfiction, like, continued to be a way that I could make money.
Sure.
And fiction is something that I still love. I'm working on another book now that is food related. And then after that, my goal is to finish this fiction project that I have.
How many books have you written?
I've written the Hot Chicken book, and then I sort of wrote some, or I guess co-wrote the Southern Foodways Alliance Community Cookbook. So those two, and I have another one under contract that is due in a month of all, so that I'm putting off.
So most
hopefully they're not listening.
So they're not. So most of your writing is like articles then in newspapers and magazines. Is that right?
I mean, a big part of it, sometimes it's regular stuff, but like, yeah, I've done features for, yeah, loads of places. Most of it is like, but recently as I've been teaching more, I've been like, so, I was teaching when I wrote the Hot Chicken book. And as I'm writing this one that, like I said, is due now, which is kind of more about sort of a, for lack of a better term, like the positive. It's not like I call it a cooking book and not a cookbook, but it's for people who are maybe sort of intimidated or afraid or don't even know like how to, like they maybe want to cook, but they're intimidated by seeing all these competition chef shows on TV and they don't know where to start basically. And so part of this came out of like talking with people in recovery, you know, fresh out of, you know, recovery perhaps, or, I've talked before with a lady who teaches, cooking to folks who come back from, you know, overseas with PTSD from being in the military and such. So like, I had this idea of like cooking being something that you could use to kind of like, as not to like heal yourself, but to kind of, you know, maybe, gain self-esteem. It's basically, if somebody didn't know where to begin, this book is kind of like, here's where you begin, and here's a way to frame cooking. So it's not like, I can't do this, but more like, I can do this.
I watch a lot of Hell's Kitchen, and I find myself yelling at the screen, how can you not cook a piece of fish? all the time. but I don't get intimidated, even though I would probably, if I had to cook 100 pieces of fish, I'm sure they wouldn't all come out great. So
they don't. Well, and that's the thing. One of the things I say in there is kind of like, I kind of puncture the kind of idea that like chefs never, about use the F word there. Chefs never screw up. Chefs botch stuff all the time. They just, you don't see it on TV. And it's like making mistakes is part of like that's how, it's literally like anything else. It's like how you learn. Like you burn fish one time and then you're like the next time you're like, oh, okay, well I know what not to do this time. It's like people don't give themselves permission to fail with cooking like they would in other things.
If you feel the need to swear, go ahead. This is a safe space.
Yeah.
Just, the more colorful, the better, I always say. So,
okay.
Well, what is it that you teach currently?
I teach variously, depending on the semesters, like English, like English Comp 1, 2, creative writing. I've done writing about the humanities, or as I like to say, sometimes writing about the manatees. And then this fall at Cumberland University, I am starting to teach a journalism class, and we are going to kind of create a student-run publication from the ground up, which is exciting.
That sounds awesome. Wow. Yeah, I think the kids will really like that.
I think hopefully we're going to, do something kind of neat there, and hopefully, maybe we can help kind of kickstart. I think they had a journalism program before, and so, maybe we can help get it off the ground.
Of all the things you've ever written in your life, in your opinion, what is your best piece of work?
I have to always say this, but I honestly think it's some of the stuff in the new book that I'm writing. There's a guy named Stanley Kunitz who was a poet who his last book came out when he was 94, and they asked him what he thought, and he was like, I really think it's the best thing I've ever done. I'm glad I lived this long. And I think about that sometimes. I'm like, why writing is kind of great. It's like, you don't unless you lose your mental faculties, you don't you just get better, it's not something that you need necessarily. It's not something sports or baseball, to bring it back to baseball, where you start to see diminishing returns after a certain period of time. Writing is one of those things that you can hopefully do the rest of your life.
Well, yeah. So, life experiences is learn from your mistakes is,
I think I've done a better job. When I was younger, I was very flashy as a writer, I think. And kind of there's the quote that with writing, you're either a taker outer or a putter inner. And at that time, I was definitely a putter inner. Like somebody would say, write me 1,000 words on so-and-so. And I would turn in 2,000 thinking that all of my words were golden. And I've really seen the value of being succinct as I've gotten older. And so I feel like I was, a lot more flashy back then, but now I know how to make this, I know how to make the simple play when a simple play is all you need. And not everything has to be the flashy look at me kind of, sentence or paragraph or whatever. And so,
sure.
Because ultimately, writing is communicating, right? And so I'm starting to see now that that's the point and not me showing off my vocabulary or.
Well, let me ask you this as we transition into another subject we're going to go through. You are about 7 or 8 years sober now. Is that correct?
I had 8 years on July 25th.
How was your writing before and after?
Less ego driven. That's actually a really neat question that I've never been asked. I think less kind of, less about me and less look at me. And less kind of, I want people to know that I'm, talented, and more about how can I best tell the story, or how can I how can I best communicate this? And I think that, you know, honestly, it's like, I think the gold standard behind my writing is better, because you mentioned something earlier about life experience. And just, you know, when you get sober, you really have to own up to like some parts of your behavior. And you own up to the fact that you are not the center of the universe. I think now, like, when I write, I just don't think about myself. I think about who's going to be reading it. And I think, like, well, what do I want to get across here? And, like, am I just saying a bunch of negative stuff to be negative and to, like, get page views? Or do I want to, like, put something that's, like, meaningful out there? I'm not saying I always, like, hit that mark, but I definitely, like, think about those things more now.
It sounds like maybe you were writing before for you as the audience, and now you write for the actual audience.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. Even though I don't know who the audience is, I mean, maybe I'm still writing for me, but the me as my audience has changed. Does that make any sense?
No, it does to me.
I've used the analogy before, but like, you know, like a guitar player, you see guys that can play a million notes a minute, and you know, it's impressive, but it's not like you don't go away humming, you know, a song like that. You go away humming a song that's like just a melody that sticks in your head, that some, you know, somebody communicated a straightforward song. Like, nobody goes around humming, like, you know, progressive rock songs from 19, you know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer or something. You end up, you know, the things that, you know, I think I've just grown to see that, like, hey, it's okay to just communicate something that could, you know, be useful to somebody.
When you were going through your, I'll just say drinking problem, I guess is the best way to put it. The sobriety happened. Were you
active alcoholism? Is how I was.
Active alcoholism. All right. Yeah. Did you hit rock bottom, or did you just have enough?
I hit my bottom. My bottom wasn't as, everybody's like, sort of like, I don't know if you would call it a motivating event. It's different. Like, mine was that I sensed that I was getting exhausted, and my path at the time was unsustainable. But the precipitating event of me getting sober was getting a DUI. It wasn't Your Honor, you know, I just blew like point, you know, like I just blew a tiny bit over the limit or whatever. And so like, I had like a 0.20, which, you know, in Tennessee, the limit is like 0.8. So I was pretty sure that was not like normal drinking, you know?
Sure.
And I had noticed it. It was trending in the wrong direction. And I knew that it was. And, yeah, I think I had always, like, I jumped around. I've shared this in a few meetings over the years, but I used to always say that, you know, people would be like, what do you want in your epitaph? And I wanted to say, Timothy Davis, he never spent a day in jail. And then turns out I got to spend a few days in jail for my DUI. And so I was like, well, I guess I can't use that anymore. But it was just one of those things that I was kind of like, it forced me to look at, like, hey, what are you, you know, this is what you want to be doing? Who are you? You know, like, I the best way I can to describe it, on the off chance that somebody's listening and is wondering about themselves, is that I didn't recognize myself anymore. And that really scared me. So that the DUI was what made me kind of like finally be like, you know, the record scratch moment where you're like, okay, something has gone really off the rails.
Well, kudos to you for acknowledging and recognizing what was happening, because I would say in most cases of somebody who has a drinking problem, I don't think a DUI is necessarily going to put an end to it. So you saw what was going on I think a little bit earlier than most. Would you say I'm wrong or right on that?
I mean, it's tough to say. I definitely know people who have had multiple ones. And I know people that have had multiple ones who never got sober, and then people who had multiple ones who got sober. I know people that never had one that got sober. It's I would say if I'm being honest with you, I don't know what it was about. Like, I don't know why all of a sudden I had that sort of moment of clarity, if you will, other than, whatever it was, whether it was shame or whatever else, or, you know, if you want to ascribe it to a higher power or something. But for some reason that day, you know, I allowed myself to kind of consider, like, hey, like, you need to try something else. And so I started, we all know what I'm talking about, but I started a 12-step program like a couple of weeks later, and knock on wood, I haven't had a drink since.
Well, congratulations to you on that. That is a success story in itself, along with all of your writing and your vintage baseball happiness and everything.
As I mentioned to you, it's kind of like it allowed me to, like, these things that I wanted to try. Like, it's allowed me to kind of, like, go back and, like, I keep using the phrase, I guess, but kind of be a kid again and kind of, like, be like, hey, like, this baseball thing looks interesting. Why don't you try that? My wife and I joke all the time that, like, I have some new passion about every 3 or 4 weeks. But it's like, it's all these things that I wanted to try, and I never...
Oh, my God, I'm the same way.
But... I never had a chance to. And I'm like, what's the harm? Like, I'm not, like, spending the mortgage or anything on these things. But, you know, like, if I decide I want to, like... I like bicycling, so I decided I bought this old Schwinn bicycle from the 1950s, and I'm going to, like, restore it. And I was like, you know, I know a little bit about, like, bike mechanics, but I've, like, never done this before. And I'm like, well, this is how I learn, you know, this would be something cool to do. And so I have lots of projects and stuff now that I not only have time for, but it's like all these things that I, like, I'm way more curious these days than I was when I was still drinking, you know, because when you're drinking, it's kind of, I say when you're drinking, but when you're addicted to anything, you're always going to be kind of selfish because you're addicted to something that you're always kind of chasing. And so you don't have a lot of time for everything else, you know? And sure. Now, like, there's a whole lot of time that opens up literally.
Yeah. It's amazing what happens when your head is sober, how different the world looks through that. I wish my son would stop smoking pot all the time and would get a little of that, but I digress. He won't listen to this. He's 23 years old. It's too late.
I did some of that myself. So.
There's nothing wrong with it, but I don't think he's stopped in 7 years.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to say, too, that, like, I don't necessarily just, you know, if there's, you know, somebody that owns a brewery or something that's listening, like, I don't have anything against drinking either. It's not for me anymore. You know, like, I don't mean to, like, the last thing I ever want to do is, like, sound preachy to someone. There's a saying in 12-step rooms of attraction, not promotion. So if somebody is having an issue, then you offer to be of service to them. But if not, you know, like, I don't, like, my friends are like, I'm going to go to this place, or do you want to go somewhere? And, like, or, you know, we would go out to a restaurant. They would be like, do you care if I order a beer? I'm like, I don't care. Like, as long as you don't, like, hold me down and pour it in my mouth.
Right. Absolutely.
Our team now goes out, like, after every game, pretty much we go out and we go and eat. And, you know, a lot of the guys have some beers or two or three. And, you know, it's just like, I hang out with them and I have all the fun and camaraderie, but, you know, I drink a iced tea.
All right. And we've come to the part of the show, the last segment of the show, which is when I pepper you with some quick questions and you just give some quick answers. Just the first
thing. It's a little scary, but
you'll be all right.
We'll be fine. Yeah.
All right, here we go. What is the strangest food you've ever had?
Oof. Man, that's a, I guess, like animal testicle.
Oh, that's a good one. What was the animal? Follow-up question.
I'm not even sure. I wanted to say they were like bull testicles or something. It was something that I had at like a, it was kind of a wacky food event here at Nashville. This was also when I was drinking. So yeah, take that with a grain of salt.
What is,
I may not have eaten it sober. Let's put it that.
Okay. you were drunk and had balls in your mouth. Is that what we're saying here? Well, why don't we just come out and say it? What is your Mount Rushmore of authors?
Oh, wow. Off the top of my head, like Cormac McCarthy, Eudora Welty, John Steinbeck, and there's a poet, Yusef Kumanyaka, who I like a lot. So I'll throw him in there.
Do you acknowledge pineapple as a pizza item?
I do. I worked at a pizza restaurant, and I've never understood the hate towards pineapple on a pizza. I like the mix of savory and sweet. So.
What was the first concert you ever attended?
The Monkees reunion tour, 1986, 87.
Wow.
I would like to add that the next two concerts were Van Halen and Metallica.
You're just trying to make the Monkees seem better.
I am. Totally, yeah.
What is your spirit animal?
Probably a cat. I really love cats. I've been fortunate in my life to have very sociable cats. So, like, I've never really had a cat who just, like, lay there and, like, my cats are very dog-like, so.
What is your favorite smell? And I assume it's not the litter box.
Wait, what?
What is your favorite smell?
Oh, yeah, not the litter box. I really like the smell of like a campfire, that sort of smoky.
Oh yeah. Kind of smell. Who is the most overrated Avenger?
Oh boy. Who's in the Avengers currently? I haven't watched a whole lot of these movies recently. I'm a big Marvel guy, but I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know.
I can tell you my favorite would be Iron Man.
Well, that's so he's not overrated. He's like the OG of the Avengers on the screen anyway. I don't know about the comics, but who's an Avenger that sucks?
Let's say Captain America.
Ooh, hot take. What was your first car?
Oh, my first car was a Chrysler K car. Which is when Lee Iacocca took over Chrysler, and he made these. It was said to be a breakthrough at the time that he made these cheap little cars that everyone could afford. The car would barely do 60 miles an hour, and at one point would not. I could not put it in reverse, so I always had to park in a parking lot like a mile away from everyone else.
When you cook at home, and you say you don't cook a lot, and you're not a master chef for sure, but what is your signature go-to dish when you cook?
Oh, I do cook a lot at home. My signature go-to dish, I'm a really good sandwich maker. But I really love Italian food, so I would say I can whip together some really good Italian food.
All right, and last question. What is your newly formed Wu-Tang Clan vintage baseball name?
Oh, see, now this we've already thought about. we were discussing, my team and I, how like we should be able to have multiple nicknames, because you come up with more nicknames than you get to use. So my second name was going to be Feed Sack, and then my third name was going to be Pulled Pork. So Shade Tree, and then Feed Sack, and then Pulled Pork.
Pulled Pork is my favorite. it is amazing. Hey, Timothy Charles Davis, not a serial killer. Thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
There's always time, right?
Don't. Well, yeah, there is. Nobody starts out on a serial killer. That's the old adage about that. But thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it. I love trying to get. I really need more Tennessee people, but I've had a few, and you guys do it right down there in my eyes, and I wish you good luck through your season. I wish you good luck through your writing and your constant sobriety is always a battle. Even when you're doing it well, as you are, it's still a battle. And I wish you all the best, my friend.
Well, thank you for having me on. I think you sold yourself short as an interviewer. This was actually a hell of a lot of fun, and like some questions that I've never been asked before. And it was just, it was a heck of a lot of fun. I hope to be back, not be back on in the future, but to hear more folks in the future. And I think it's a really neat thing you're doing to be able to see sort of behind the scenes of all the different kind of folks that we have playing this game that we love, and how it can be a kind of a connecting point to get to know people.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the kind words. Stay on the line for me so I can give you the appropriate goodbye off the air. As I say goodbye to everybody that listened, thank you for your continued support. I will continue to get interviews out there for you. As I know, a lot of guys contact me and say that when they travel to the games, they throw these episodes in. So I'll keep throwing them out there to you. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next time.